Everyone, good evening. My name is Sean. I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Sean.
Thank you all so very much for having me down here. This is my first time to a meeting in Madison. Thank you, Dale, for asking me to come. My sobriety date is January 1st, 2013. That was not a New Year's resolution, more of an act of desperation. 2012, I was not exactly on a winning streak. I have a sponsor. I have a home group, which is the Peace and Recovery at Peace Lutheran in Charlottesville. And I sponsor other men as it's outlined in the big book. I love the fact that you guys start. And when Dale asked me to speak, he said, you know, we our format is based on the last two paragraphs on page 29. And I was thinking it was a topic meeting, you know, and I've read the book, you know, hundreds of times. But when it puts it in context that way, it's just really well articulated. And on the way down here before I came, I was just reading each individual in the personal story describes in his own language and from his own point of view, the way he established his relationship with God. In my experience, that was a very crooked path. That was not straight and narrow or linear. So I was born and raised in Charlottesville, Virginia. My grandfather was actually born here in Madison. He was a Wheatley from down in Wheatley Hollow and lived most of his life in Culpeper. But most all of my family is from Charlottesville, and alcoholism runs very deep in my family. Since I've gotten sober, I've had three immediate family members die from our disease. And, you know, I've stared that in the eyes, just wishing that I could give away willingness. And it's a heartbreaking thing to watch, you know. My grandfather on my dad's side, he was the captain of the police department in Charlottesville. And, you know, my dad was the oldest of five, and he would tell me stories about, you know, his father. I never got to meet him. He died also from alcoholism very young, but he would get off work and having to provide for five kids, they'd go paint. And, you know, as soon as he got off work, still in uniform, half gallon of moonshine or Beam or whatever he had underneath there, would chug it and go about his business. Have another great uncle who, in a blackout up near the JPA meeting in Charlottesville, passed out on the train tracks, lost both of his legs, was run over by a train, never stopped a day in his life drinking. You know, that was literally just a bump in the road for him. And the meeting at Church of Our Savior on Rio Hill, my uncles helped build that church. And that's pretty special because, you know, being in a church that was built by alcoholics, I hear this story. It's in the main meeting room where my uncle was putting the trusses on the roof, drunk, fell straight through the middle floor all the way into the basement, you know, in a blackout. And, you know, those are just a couple of stories of what the disease looks like in my family. And, you know, I'm the first one to make it into recovery by the grace of God somehow. And, you know, I was reading the promises this morning with my wife, and I was just thinking about all of the things that this program has given me. Not only that I didn't know that I wanted, but did not believe in whatsoever. You know, I was very, very angry when I came into the rooms. And that goes back all the way to the beginning of my childhood. So as I said, I was born in Charlottesville. And, you know, some of my first memories are around alcohol. And my first main memory was a life changer for me. And it was one of those, I'm taking it to the grave type of things. And this was up at U-Haul, the old basketball arena for UVA. And I was getting swim lessons from the age of maybe 5 to 7. And, you know, my innocence was stripped from me at a very early age by a swim coach and family friend. Myself and three other best friends were getting abused by this man. And it wasn't anything in a violent, scary manner, but it was enough to really mess up my programming, so to speak, and how I would operate on a daily basis. So that was kind of one of those first, odd, traumatic moments that, in response to that, from a very early age, I was out, as a pyromaniac. I was sneaking up to UVA as a 7, 8 year old, stealing, shoplifting, carrying on. My first pair of handcuffs that I got was actually at the age of 12. And between 12 and the time I got sober, I would find myself in 16 other pair of handcuffs and 5 trips to the psych ward, just suicidal as can be. I was a late bloomer with drinking. As a result of the things that happened to me as a child, I was a really skinny kid and was picked on quite a bit. And I believe it to be part of my alcoholism, honestly, that everything I've ever done has been 110% or not at all, whether it was good for me, bad for me, or indifferent. And as a teenager, I got into weightlifting and became a personal trainer up at the Gold's Gym in Charlottesville. And I just took it to a level that I didn't know I was capable of. And by the time I was 18, I'd become the top teenage bodybuilder in the country and was ranked third in the world and was traveling internationally. Had a lucrative six-figure contract at the age of 18, was on these magazine covers and whatnot. And I really thought that I'd arrived. I always had that feeling. And it's the most common thing when you read any of the stories from the back of the big book. It just says, I always felt separate, different, and alone. That was a very common thing for me and other alcoholics when I first came into the rooms that I would find. And, when I had all that success as a teenager, I had all these amazing moments, which I really think are wonderful. I got to have dinner with Arnold Schwarzenegger and, just all these different neat little things. But the bottom line was, I remember getting gold medals and all these, wonderful trophies and attaboys. And still at the bottom of my soul, I just felt like I'm not enough. This is not it. This is not fulfilling me. This is not that thing that I thought would fix everything about me. And so I had a coach, and we were down in Charlotte, North Carolina. And this was after a competition. And we went out to this club just to celebrate. And he asked me if I wanted a drink. I was in a great mood, never, had a drink before. And I said, "Yeah, what is that? Is it strong?" He said, "No, it's a Long Island iced tea. They're real light." And so I proceeded to have five, six of them that first at bat. And I always say my first drunk was the exact same as my last, a total blackout. I was a daily blackout drinker for over a decade. And so where I'd gone from, Mr. Health and Fitness, just completely 180, just like overnight into Mr. Drugs and Alcohol, I kind of transitioned from the bodybuilding thing into being a bouncer because it seemed like a good fit. So I worked up at UVA on the corner quite a bit. And, it just took off like a rocket, my disease. I was married very young. I got married for the first time when I was 20 years old to my high school sweetheart. We've been together from the age of 15 till I was 32 when I first got sober, actually. And she was a wonderful woman, still is to this day. And she went through a lot with an alcoholic husband who was just a daily blackout drinker. She watched me kind of go from, the top thinking I'd had, life all figured out by the age of 20, and just an absolute crash landing. And we have two children, and the firstborn is handicapped. He was born special needs. He has autism and cerebral palsy in this missing chromosome. And I remember I was at home drunk as usual. Doctors from UVA call me up and they're like, "Sean, I'm sorry to tell you this, but Landon is missing chromosome." And they named off this 4P sections 15.1. They had this long. I was like, "Well, what's that mean?" And they're like, "Well, we don't really know, because we've only been tracking the human genome for a number of decades." But for a very long time, that was a absolutely get drunk, and go to jail type of excuse for me. And it was just horrendous. It was absolutely horrendous. And I was not a present father or husband for them. Landon did go on to walk. The doctor said, "We don't know if he'll ever walk or talk or anything." And he just graduated from high school last year. And he is 6'6". And so, young man, discipline him, looking straight up. It's a funny thing, but he's a immensely good boy. And he actually a couple years ago won a trip for the Make-A-Wish Foundation, and we got to go all as a blended family down to Disney World. And on that trip, my current wife, who I met in the rooms, went along with my ex-wife. And when I tell you the story, you'll understand a little better why that's so amazing. Because, in the end of my first marriage, I had a protective order put against me. I was kicked out of my home, house taken, kids taken. And, at the age of 33, had to move back in with my parents. And that was not what I wanted the beginning of sobriety to look like, I first attempted to get into AA in 2009. And by the time, I could go on with war stories forever, but I'd much rather, what happened, You guys are in here, and so you know my story. But I was a daily blackout drinker. I was a jails and institutions guy, multiple DUIs, fighting and carrying on, and was just very violent. I was very Jekyll and Hyde. I am that alcoholic type. I think it's fascinating in the book where it talks about the moderate drinker, the heavy drinker, and the real alcoholic as it's outlined. And there seems to be a fine line between that heavy drinker and the real alcoholic. The big book says a heavy drinker can have health issues, consequences, but if with enough encouragement, they want to stop, then they can, And that just was not me. That was not me whatsoever. And when I first tried to get sober as a result of, being threatened, with, leaving me and so forth. I feel like I first tried to get sober for others, and as a result of sticking around, it actually really, I realized I was in the right place. But, I often tell people I came into the rooms at first with just a lot of physical pain and back issues. I just wanted the judge off my back, the wife off my back, I mean, that's what it was about for me first. And I'll never forget that first day of trying to get sober. I had horrendous DTs. At the time I was drinking every day a fifth to a half a gallon of bourbon, copious amounts of narcotics. I was a heavy cocaine user. Anything I could get my hands on, really, I would use. And I just remember just shaking like a leaf, hallucinating, and ending up in the hospital and sleeping almost for 24 hours straight. And when I first went into the rooms, I was still very, very resistant, very scared. My childhood best friend had already been in for about 10 years, and that's who brought me to my first meeting. The funniest thing about my first meeting. I wasn't the guy who would bounce around from liquor store to liquor store. I always just blatantly rolled up to the same old one. It used to be Albemarle Square. And so I got to know everybody, you know. And when I got to my first meeting, I noticed the gentleman who gave me my white chip was the same gentleman that sold me my last half gallon at the liquor store. I kid you not. You know, and I thought he was there just to offer a group discount for us. You know, I mean, truly just very naive as to what was going on. But you know, even with enough consequences, I often think consequences for us as alcoholics can be irrelevant. You know, if we don't have that internal misery, that internal suffering, that absolutely point of defeat and utter despair, you know, those four horsemen were on me on a daily basis, waking up, you know. And so I was about 30 days in 2009 into recovery, and I sat at my first speaker meeting by a guy who was just reeking of my beverage of choice. He just smelled of bourbon. And, you know, I still hadn't really plugged in to know what was going on. And I just was like, maybe they just learn how to drink, you know, a half gallon like a gentleman. And that's what I wanted. You know, I really did. I just wanted the consequences and the pain to go away. You know, drinking was not my problem. It was my solution for a very long time. I love the sayings, you know, drinking goes from fun to fun with problems to just problems. And that progression happened very quickly for me. I was in a Zoom meeting during COVID, and I heard someone describe that same progression as three songs. First, they said, you know, it started off Rolling Stones, I Can't Get No Satisfaction, right? Then it progressed into AC/DC, Highway to Hell. And finally, we ended up here with Amazing Grace. You know, and I thought that was just really, really beautiful. So during 2009 to when I finally was relieved of my obsession to drink, you know, on New Year's Eve of 2012, I went that entire period for 2.5 years, I went without drinking. And I was nonstop using drugs, you know, and thinking still that I was sober because alcohol was my problem. And doing just a pure cocaine diet and not drinking was not a pleasant time, you know. And so when I first came back into the rooms, I was absolutely defeated. I was absolutely licked. And I found out at the time that my first wife was having an affair. She was a middle school teacher, and I just could not accept that fact that she had, you know, cheated on me, despite the fact that I had at least seven affairs that I knew of, you know. And truly, I was just so hypocritical, just so full of self-centeredness and a belief that it's all about me. Just absolutely, just had no direction, no purpose, and it was really difficult. And so, you know, I stayed immensely rageful. And when I first came in, I had no belief in any kind of higher power whatsoever. You know, I love the story of our founders where Roland Hazard, who would go on to, you know, share with Abby, who would share with Bill the solution. He goes overseas. I think this is page 26 in the book, and he meets with Carl Jung. And Carl Jung says, "I have never met a chronic alcoholic of your variety recover." And I love the language. It says, right then, it felt like the gates of hell had shut with a clang. And then he says, "Are there no exceptions?" And Carl Jung says, "Yes, they've been happening since the beginning of time." And he calls them vital spiritual experiences. And that's what you have to have, is what he said. And So then you can scroll to the back of the big book, and it says three things that are absolutely indispensable to have this so-called spiritual awakening or spiritual experience. And that is willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness. And at my first attempt at sobriety, I felt as though I had the honesty component down. I absolutely knew that I was an abnormal drinker, and I could not drink like anyone else or everyone else. But I absolutely was not willing to take suggestions still. And so I really, in that first year of 2013 to 2014, my very first year of sobriety comes with very strong fair warnings. And I feel like I did every step wrong. But most importantly, as a dry drunk, I still, without alcohol in my system, found myself getting arrested and being suicidal and ending up in psych wards. And heard this old timer recently say a good description of alcoholism is, take alcohol away from a person, and do they just mentally clear up? Do they just get better without having to implement anything? Or if they get sicker, if they start getting more irritable, restless, and discontent, then that to me is a good definition of alcoholism, because with the implementation of a spiritual solution does our type get better, and I wholeheartedly believe that in my experience. So going through the first three steps, the first step, like I said, powerless, unmanageable, check, absolutely. But I had a real hard time with this higher power and God stuff. And I felt as though I was somewhere in between maybe atheist and an agnostic, But it turns out that I was just full of a whole lot of fear. I was full of a lot of fear and a lot of anger. But desperate enough, I chose to accept that I'm not God, and maybe there's something out there. And my sponsor said, "Well, we can look at it this way. Let's look at the first three steps this way. The first step is you put down a drink. The second step is you had an inkling of hope or faith, and you showed up to a meeting. So that's like coming to make a decision, And then the third step is you kept coming back. That's turning over, showing up over and over is that third step for me. And so I was willing to, I really felt I wanted some burning bush type of moment, but my experiences of the educational variety and the sometimes slowly, I definitely had claw marks in my big book, kicking and fighting the whole way. One of the most important parts of my story is when I got to my fourth step with my sponsor. And I'll never forget what he said to me. We were sitting having coffee on the downtown mall in Charlottesville, and he looked up and smiled at me, and he said, "All right, let's get right to it. Tell me the one thing you came here not to tell me." And I like a good alcoholic, I looked them right in the eyes and I lied. And that is an example of half measures. And it didn't get me nothing, but it got me to continue to be crazy. We're only as sick as our secrets, and I was not willing to share, that stuff from my childhood, the anger that I had towards this alleged higher power for giving me a handicapped child, the number of times that I'd been arrested, the fact that I just simply could not stop drinking. And in my eyes, I went from this successful teenager to this just absolute burnout. And, in the end, I found myself in situations. I was literally, driving up and down the East Coast with four other guys with a truckload of things that would still have me in prison to this day, and hanging out with kingpins and convicted murderers, in the middle of very seedy places up in New York, Harlem, just looking around in places that I knew that I didn't belong. And yet that was another part of my addiction, was just more and more and more. So like I said, in that first year, as a result of holding back, not putting both feet into recovery, I just stayed miserable. And the last thing I remember about the last night I was with my first wife was just literally just seeing red, just absolutely enraged, just going crazy. And I punch a hole in the wall and just straight through it. And I'll never forget. And it still feels a bit like shame when I can still see in my eyes, that terror in my children's eyes. And I didn't see when I came around how any of this made any sense, or how my life could ever be without despair and shame and guilt and misery. And my favorite daily reflection is January 28th, and it's called The Treasures of the Past. And it's from the family afterwards, and it says, "Cling to the fact that in God's eyes, our darkest hours become our greatest asset, the very thing in which we can share with the newcomer to help them avert death, misery, and suffering." And that changed my life. Just looking at the fact of, okay, here's your purpose. You did a lot of dark, scary, ugly things. There's going to be guys that are coming in behind you. And my sponsor told me, he said, "One day you're going to be in a meeting, Sean, and you're going to hear your story being repeated back to you. And in you sharing that very thing that you just shared with me, you may save another man's life." And so it's amazing to me that I went from, with this information, I'm never going to, share that with anyone, not even, share with God, myself, and another human being. But today I can stand up here and share that with you all when it be is of benefit to another alcoholic, I believe. And I remember during COVID, I was listening. It was an international women's conference, and my wife was listening to it. And there was this woman, I'll never forget what she said. And this is a lady from up in New York, and she was a prostitute and a heroin addict, and her pimp had nearly beaten her to death in the end of her addiction, and she woke up with needles in her arm. And after sharing her story, one of the young ladies who wanted to work with her came up to her and said, "It's just amazing. Like, how are you able to get up at that podium and share all of that?" And what she said still gives me cold chills. She says, "Because when I get up here and share what happened to me and what I've done, it gives you permission to share what happened to you." And that's that connection point, permission to share. When we share with another alcoholic, the darkness, the language of the heart, we can just see and feel that pain, that suffering, humiliation. And that's what we have to give to each other. I first went through the big book and tried to do it on my own. I was like, "All right, there's a solution. Okay, good. How it works, let's just read those two and just get right to it." And so I'd skipped over the forewords. And I remember maybe at that year point going back, and there's this part in the foreword to the second edition, which also just absolutely hit me between the eyes. And it talks about what I believe to be Bill and Lois's kind of white light moment. And it says, "Prior to his journey to Akron, the New York stockbroker, Bill Wilson, had worked diligently on the theory that only an alcoholic could help another. But he had succeeded only in staying sober himself." And, I've heard the story about how he was just so frustrated. He's going around trying to save all the drunks, like an evangelist type dude. And he's frustrated, and he says to Lois, "I don't get it. I'm helping all these guys and nobody's staying sober." And she looks at him and says, "But you are." You know, and that is it. And in the book, it says, this seems to prove that, you know, diligent work with another alcoholic was the solution for permanent sobriety, is how it words it. And you know, that to me explained to me, you know, the triangle, our legacies of unity, which is what we're doing right here, showing up and sharing about alcoholism, recovery, working the steps with someone who came before us, and then service, which is to share the very message in which we were given to another alcoholic. You know, I went through character defects, and I still am looking for my cap and gown from AA sometimes. You know, I expect to be valedictorian, and I really did. I had this, you know, I'm going to be the best at this. I'm going to do it just like I did with weightlifting. I'm just going to crush this. And, you know, I was looking for my medal and to have graduated from, you know, after I do the steps. And I remember when, you know, we sat down to do step 6 and 7. And it says, you know, after this, you know, we go home, quietly review what we've done. Is the foundation solid? All of that type of stuff. And I really felt like I had some type of experience in asking God, you know, in looking at all that had happened to me in my life, steps 4 and 5. And my sponsor said, you know, this isn't a shame, Sean list. This is just looking at repetitive patterns of your history. This is just data collection, you know? And so it's like, what in my history? Okay, I'm angry, I'm fearful, I'm self-centered to the core. And so, you know, that's the very thing in which I need to take a look at. And you know, when I went home, I remember just feeling like, wow, like I'm never going to be angry again. I'm never going to be selfish again. You know? Just still full of delusion and everything. But my sponsor had me write down two columns for step 6 and 7, and it was almost like an assets and liabilities list, you know. And so we wrote down all of the character defects being my liabilities. And you know, I thought my only liability was alcohol, and yet it says in the big book, we got to get down to causes and conditions. And so we really took a long time to eyeball all of those things which made Sean tick, which continued to keep me in that perpetual cycle of relapse and my alcoholism. And I think it's really important for me to know not just what I'm trying to get away from, these things I mentioned, selfishness, the anger and so forth. I need to know what the opposite of that is. What's the asset of fear? Faith. You know, what's the maybe the opposite of anger? Maybe being of service or being helpful to somebody, you know. And so those are the things when I say my prayers today and I'm asking, you know, God to relieve me from the bondage of self, you know, I have a good awareness of the things that keep me away from you know, and I have to ask this higher power for help in becoming, you know, of faith, of service, because that's just not my default. You know, in waking up today with alcoholism, you know, I still am full of ego. And I love the book A New Pair of Glasses by the old timer Chuck C. And he says in his book, one of the famous lines, he says, "Alcoholic, one problem and one problem only, and one solution." And he says, "Problem is our ego." And he defines ego as conscious separation from what? He doesn't say, just conscious separation from. And that's from the universe. That's from me to you, from me to being useful. You know, I am just cut off by that. And especially when I'm in the midst of addiction, you know, there is no connection. I'm just completely isolating from you and just worried about Sean. And so the solution, of course, is conscious contact. And what that looks like for me today is starting my day in the third step prayer, and getting on my knees and asking God to remove from me that obsession to drink, and also to remove these character defects which prevent me from being useful to you. I'll never forget, the first couple of guys that I worked with, and I was supposed to meet this one guy downtown for coffee, and we were going to work on the first step. And he had just gotten out of jail, and he calls me up, "Sean, I'm not going to be able to meet you for coffee. What's going on, man? You all right?" "Yeah, but I got to go over in the valley and make amends to that girl I was telling you about." "That the one that put you in jail and said, don't ever talk to me again?" "Yeah, that's her." And I see these types of things, and definitely realize that these steps are in order for a reason. And I really felt once I got through my own amends, my sponsor was like, "Sean, you need to start raising your hand and offering to take other guys through the steps." I was mortified by that. That seemed like a lot, a big responsibility. And I was like, "Dude, did you listen to anything I've shared with you? Did you hear that four step?" I said, "I am certifiably insane. Dude, I'm crazy." He said, "That's exactly what you have to offer." Because I was like, "What could I possibly offer another alcoholic?" He said, "Sean, you're not a rocket scientist. You're no genius. You are an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. Your insanity is all you have to share with another." And that's the solution for me today in staying sober, and I have been so blessed with working with a number of guys and have gone through various step studies and learned how to do the steps in, slightly different ways, all of which are the foundation of the big book. And I'll share my experience with amends. My biggest amends was, of course, to my first wife, and her family, because all of them had, jointly just they were real scared of me and who I was when I was trying to get sober, and certainly who I was in a blackout. And what I thought amends was about was reconciliation. So I went into my amends with a lot of expectations. I don't recommend it. And so I remember, trying to do that amends with my first wife, and she didn't want to hear it. She didn't want to have anything of it, and I was confused. And so I thought maybe I just need to say it louder, and that didn't go over well either. But my sponsor pointed out something in the third step prayer, because I really was very codependent, very needy, wanted everybody to, like me, because I wasn't okay in my own skin by myself, left to my own devices. I'm uncomfortable with who I am and the way I think. And that has been really, really tough for me. I'm sure it stems back from a lot from a young age, but my disease and the places that it took me, just left me in this place of just self-centered fear and needing for you to give me approval and tell me that I'm okay just the way I am. And I don't need that today. It's just miraculous that I have come to believe in a power greater than myself that can restore me to sanity over the helpless and hopeless condition of alcoholism, because I wanted nothing, absolutely nothing to do with that, and it's miraculous. And I really almost, when I'm working with guys who are somewhere in that atheist and agnostic place, I welcome it. I welcome it with open arms, because I get it, and for me, what's so amazing about this stuff in the 12th step, it says, "Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of doing this stuff, it's just in taking the steps, just taking these actions." And I really thought that I had to have, like I said, some burning bush moment. I'll start levitating here any minute, and the dude with the white beard will float down from the clouds. But I didn't have any of that. What I did have was the removal of the obsession to drink and get completely annihilated and blacked out every single day. And that was not my doing, you know. And so it was by the time that I got through the steps, I was just like dumbfounded by what happened here, you know. And that is just part of the divinity or the amazing, amazing creation of our program that we're just so blessed to have. Going back to the amends and so forth, my sponsor pointed out the wording in the third step prayer. You know, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. And this is the part he pointed out. Take away my difficulties so that victory over them may bear witness to those I may help. So take away my difficulties. What are my difficulties? I can't stay sober. I'm a lunatic. I'm a rageaholic. I am a scared person when I'm in that state of mind. But with this higher power, take away my difficulties so the victory over them, not doing that stuff anymore, may bear witness. So he point what he was pointing out was these people don't have to love you. They don't have to accept you, but they will, if you're around them, bear witness to the magic and amazingness of this thing you're doing, higher power, whatever you want to call it, God. And I tell you what, you know, it does feel like a story out of the back of the book. You know, I kind of think of my little story as from protective orders to Disney World. You know, I mean, with that first wife, we sat on that plane together. We hug each other when we see each other. And this woman wanted me dead. You know, she really, really hurt a lot because I hurt her a whole lot. And that protective order stayed in play for over a year. And we didn't speak. You know, we did not speak. I couldn't see my kids. I had to have supervised visitation, you know, all of that type of stuff. And, you know, the person that I am today as a result of this program is not the same person who arrived. You know, it's just not. And I have to pinch myself sometimes. You know, I'm driving down the road. We didn't break the law today. You know, not on purpose anyway. I mean, seriously, when you're, you know, in our state of mind, you know, driving drunk, you know, doing things to get whatever you need to get, that self-centered, you know. But when I find myself in an AA meeting, you know, with other people just like me, and I'm able to share like the worst of my stuff and get a couple nods and yeah, been there. You know, I know I'm not alone anymore. And I am a part of, and that is just such a gift. I'll tell you one more story. I'm almost get to the end. My beautiful wife, who I adore more than anything, we came into the rooms both in 2013. Now, I had seen this woman for about 2 years, you know, and she witnessed all of the absolute insanity that was my life in early recovery and so forth. She often jokes when telling her story, like, "So I heard he got a protective order, and I just fell in love right away." Not a glum lot or a healthy. The hotbed of mental health in here. But we went on our first date. It was about 2 years in, single dad, you know, back, you know, in my home and with my kids. And I go on this date with my wife, Shannon. And all along, I felt like I recognized her from somewhere. And she grew up in Charlottesville too. And we were just sitting there at this Italian restaurant. I said, "Did you know Scott and Sarah?" And she said, "Yeah, I was in their wedding." And I was like, "I was in their wedding." So 7 years before we get sober, down in the Outer Banks, Shannon and I had walked each other down the aisle, hung out that entire weekend, had dances together, you know, in our first marriages. And just didn't remember because we were just wasted the whole weekend. You know, and at that moment when it was like, and you know, her friend to this day, She gave us, a picture about, the time when we first got married of us, 8 years ago, all dressed up in tuxes and so forth. And it was just one of those God winks, that here I this amazing woman who I've met in recovery, I had an experience with her before. And it is such a gift, to be married to someone as crazy as me, who understands me. I really do mean that. And the alcoholic relationship, it can be very challenging. And when both parties are working a solid program, it can be the most amazing thing you have ever seen. But we have to stay diligent about that. And when one of us is slightly off, it hurts. When both of us are off, two alcoholics, two sickies don't make a welly, is what my sponsor used to say. But she really is. I mean, she has done so much for me. And I remember when we were just friends, she taught me about writing a gratitude list, just because all I would do is come into meetings and just whine and complain, poor me, And so to this day, we've had the opportunity to travel around. We get to share our stories sometimes together, kind of jointly. The house in which I grew up in, which I turned into a brothel and a drug den at one point, is now a men's meeting location, and that's just miraculous, because it was really dark in the end of my drinking. And today, I have a real sense of joy and serenity. And, all of that is thanks to you. I thank you all so much for having me up here tonight. I appreciate you all, and thanks for letting me share.